second time I've had a chance to give a talk at ASA, and this triggered actually getting to the point of preparing a talk on radiocarbon and biblical archaeology, which I've been intending to do for a couple of years. So Steve's little needle to me got me going. I will talk about Edom and copper smelting that has been observed in an archaeological dig and show where it is. And we will talk about Hezekiah's tunnel and some of the radiocarbon data that has been obtained of Hezekiah's tunnel. I will be showing slides with graphs and things. If any of you want to stand up and move closer to the front, I'm not embarrassed about that. I have all the fonts as large as I possibly can. I think you'll be okay, but if you choose to do that, I'm quite okay with that. I will be talking about the formation of radiocarbon up in the upper atmosphere, the very critical step and why it's necessary of calibration to tree rings and barv-type sediments. Then we'll get specifically to the biblical archaeology context. And I'm going to make some comments about the creation workshops that those several of us that are involved with Solid Rock Lectures have prepared, and I will solicit your assistance in getting into the right seminaries where we should take this. My first group of slides are those that we use directly for the creation workshops and seminaries, and you will notice that they're in general ways, in ways that we believe that anybody, even without a science background, can understand. And in that setting, of course, with questions, we can answer those questions. Radiocarbon is the form of carbon that is radioactive because it has 8 neutrons in the nucleus. That makes it unstable. The dominant form of carbon is 12, and there's a secondary portion of stable carbon-13 that is also part of the carbon isotope system. The half-life of radiocarbon is 5,730 years. So this is the traditional exponential decline of a radioactive atom, starting with a specific amount. After one half-life, that amount has dropped to 50% of the original, and after a second half-life, it has dropped to 1/4 of the original, and successively on down by about 10 half-lives, there's less than 1% of that radioactivity left. The blue line here then represents for any measured amount of radiocarbon that is left in a system that's not getting additional, demonstrates the successive ages when that particular sample of radiocarbon was separated from the atmosphere, ranging from 10, 20, and on up to 50,000 years, which is approximately the limit of radiocarbon applications. Radiocarbon is formed in the upper atmosphere because cosmic rays come in and do a nuclear reaction on nitrogen-14, kicks out a proton, and it gets converted to carbon-14. That carbon then gets incorporated into carbon dioxide, which is taken up by trees and plants and vegetables that animals and we eat. So when the current tree trunk that has died falls then into the ground and is buried or onto the ground, and the tree rings prior to the current year that are taking up the level of carbon dioxide is in the atmosphere, then that radiocarbon begins to decline with its characteristic half-life. Likewise, when an animal dies and its bones end up in the ground, the amount of radiocarbon in those decays away with its half-life. So there's the radioactive decay over time, another schematic of it. Noticing, please, that my scale on the y-axis is linear from 0, from 100 down to 0, going back in time. Here I superimpose a photograph of varved cores. So the top of a varved core would have a current amount of radiocarbon, and successively going deeper and deeper, it will decay away. A sedimentary varve we interpret as forming those layers on an annual basis. Think about a lake that is in a northern climate where the ice freezes over the lake in the wintertime, the sediment material then is going to be the clays that have been carried into that river during the summer season, and those clays settle to the bottom, leaving a dark layer. In the spring, when diatoms bloom, small species bloom in the water or algae on the surface. When those animals or plants die, they fall to the bottom, leaving a light-colored layer, as shown on this photograph. You'll see that this is one of the tools that we use to calibrate radiocarbon. If I make that same graph such that my vertical scale is logarithmic, the result falls on a straight line because radioactive decay is an exponential decline process. So we're going to now compare this decay rate of carbon-14 with number of tree rings, number of varves. Notice that these are completely unrelated processes. If they're completely unrelated processes, they shouldn't necessarily relate to each other. But let's examine the data. The step for tree rings is to proceed with what is referred to as cross-dating. So, for example, there with a tree that was living recently, we can go back to the center of that tree and seek to make a correlation to a tree that has been pulled out of the cabin that was cut down years ago, and use the wet and dry cycles of growth, where wet cycles will be wide bands of the thickness of the tree ring and dry cycles will be narrow bands. If we've confirmed that for this set, then we can extend that cross-dating methodology to logs that were lying on the ground, or even back to logs, say, that have been carried down into the rivers and buried in the river mud. Let's examine that section more clearly. There's the living tree component. There's the log from the cabin. And this is an overlapping section that we're seeking to examine. On a particular year, the growth of that tree ring should have the same amount of radiocarbon in it because they both grew in the same year from this living tree, recent living tree, and the older tree that was cut down earlier. So we examine the radiocarbon in the individual rings in that overlapping section. When we do that, and if we have correlated the cross-dating correctly, the living tree should line up directly with the dead tree on a nice straight line on the tree ring count versus the percentage of radiocarbon, carbon-14, remaining. If we've done that cross-dating step, and suppose we haven't done it exactly correctly, the result will be that the dead tree radiocarbon data is somewhat offset from the living tree. So the carbon gives us a basis then of making an adjustment and confirming that our cross-dating fits between these pair of tree rings. When we look at that sequence as an example of going back 4,000 years, we have then tree ring count versus amount of radiocarbon. Samples have been collected from Hezekiah's tunnel, which I will describe in a little bit more detail later, but they have this amount of carbon-14 in them. And if we come to the tree ring count, we get 2,700 years before present, which takes back to 700 years BC. We can do the same context with some Dead Sea Scroll material that has been radiocarbon dated. It has this amount of radiocarbon, and that connects to 2,100 years before the present, or 100 BC, as examples. Now let's pull in that varve count and its amount of radiocarbon, this example from a lake in northern Minnesota. If I take that varve count and radiocarbon data and move it over on top of the tree rings, they fall right on top of each other. So we make a common sense interpretation that then counting 4,000 tree rings and counting 4,000 barbs leads us to 4,000 years of time into the past. Now let's extend that context on back to 12,000 years for tree ring and barb counts, and there's what that looks like. So likewise, 12,000 years, 12,000 barbs connects to 12,000 years into the past. Now let's take that back to about the limits of radiocarbon. This is varb data from a lake in Japan, Seogetsu Lake, which I'll mention again. And that's about the limit of carbon-14 detection for a practical context. So we treat it again as 50,000 barbs connects to 50,000 years into the past. To show one example, here my son is standing in front of the bones of a mammoth that were found in a site just south of the Black Hills. And there I'm some years ago standing in front of the research location and museum over top of the dig. And there is the dig with an enormous concentration of mammoth bones called the Mammoth Hot Springs. If you're ever traveling through South Dakota to the Black Hills, it's worth a stop. And the amount of radiocarbon in those connects to about that point on this graph. And that connects then those mammoths we interpret as having lived about 25,000 years ago. How is radiocarbon measured in the lab? There are two ways. Conventional methodology that is less expensive can be used if one has grams and grams of material, plenty of material, and it's basically counting the beta decays that come off during the decay of radiocarbon with a scintillation counter. Another methodology, which is applicable when only milligrams of the material is available, is accelerator mass spectrometry, or AMS for short. And there's a photograph of one example of one of these compact AMS systems, in this case at University of Georgia. So now I'm going to shift to more of a direct scientific perspective in the sense that showing sort of lots of data rather than just the fairly simple individual points. There is the summary of the accumulated calibration data that goes back 50,000 years that is accumulated by the radiocarbon community. The tree ring data in the green line comes up to about here, which we will look at in more detail in a few moments. From there on back in time, it includes data from Lake Seogetsu in Japan, from the Bahamas. The Carioca Basin is a sedimentary basin cut off from the open ocean of Venezuela. There's Lake Lausanne, which is the lake that was between and flooded the whole Jordan Valley between the Dead Sea and the Sea of Galilee years ago when there was more water in there. And there are two other references here. Enormous amounts of data is put into that. Keep in mind and notice that the data becomes more uncertain going back in time because we're now at a point of measuring very low levels of carbon-14 down in less than about 1 to 2% of modern carbon. So there is more uncertainty. The community has gotten together, the radiocarbon community has gotten together for numbers of years, and they put together joint effort calibration curves called NCAL. The most recent one was in 09. And I just show this again to represent the massive data between 12,000 and 14,000 calendar years. And one standard deviation envelope is in sort of thin red lines that comes up through there. So a lot of statistics are put into understanding the nature of this data because it defines the error bars then that can be put on an individual sample. Some of you had a chance to go over to Wheaton yesterday, and we saw the perimastodon that's there in our science building. And Steve Moser sent a sample of that to a radiocarbon laboratory. Here's a picture of our predecessors, or Steve's predecessors, as geology faculty members at Wheaton at a time back when they got those bones as a gift to the college. And the report that came back to Steve reported 17,700 years radiocarbon years before present. Coming to that calibration curve represents calendar years of 13,600. And the laboratory went into the fine detail of this. I'm showing it on the broad scale so that you can see the concept. Now let's focus on biblical archaeology from about the time of Christ, a little bit later, going on back to, say, 4,000 years before today. This 12,400 years is the maximum extent that cross-dating of tree rings has been accomplished. And this data specifically came from a laboratory in Germany that has collected thousands and thousands of tree trunks of European oak out of the river muds of Europe, and they put together this incredible story. So over the last 12,000 years, well covering biblical archaeology concepts, it's basically the tree ring calibration data that is used. Now, a little bit more on Hezekiah's tunnel in 2 Kings 20:20. As for the other events in Hezekiah's reign, all of his achievements, and how he made the pool and the tunnel by which he brought water into the city, are they not written in the book of the annals of the kings of Judah? There's a picture of Jerusalem map with that outline as the wall was at the time of Christ. Hezekiah's tunnel is also referred to as the Siloam Tunnel because it was to bring water into the Pool of Siloam. So it's about a half a mile long from the Gihon Springs to the Pool of Siloam. And researchers drilled about 15 drill holes into the floor of the tunnel, which was made up of plaster right on top of bedrock, as they observed. This was to prevent water from leaking into cracks and joints in the rock so that the water would get to the pool. They've done a couple of radiocarbon measurements of a piece of wood and a plant that was there, and they got radiocarbon years at 2620 before present and 2505 before present, and that interprets to the calibration age within one standard deviation of early into the 8th century BC, and about that time, consistent with the biblical record. Now, I really got triggered on this radiocarbon in the Bible when my colleague, Greg Bennett, came home to me and he said, "Ken, look what I found, a book, The Bible and Radiocarbon Dating." So I've been digging in this over the last weeks and months as I'm preparing this talk. And so I'm going to focus in on an example of that. The issues that come up in biblical archaeology, in that over a couple of decades, there's been a context of what is referred to in that community as biblical minimalism. That is, those folks that believe because the Bible was written so many years actually recorded years after the events occurred, that they do not want to treat the Bible as a history of Israel. Some claim that David and Solomon were not really kings in the sense that we understand them as we read the Bible in which we believe, but they were merely tribal leaders. Even some to the point are wondering if they existed. So this has been going on in biblical scholarship as part of the tension. Carbon 14 would have a theoretical potential to help in this. Might be getting ages of when David and Solomon were there. And the big issue is the transition from Iron Age 1 to Iron Age 2 is something that is very hotly contested. The high chronology puts that at about 1000 to 980 BC, that is the 10th century. A low chronology puts it from 920 to 900 BC, and this is contested back and forth. Notice there is only about 30 to 80 years difference in those two, And there's the position of the high chronology for Iron Age 1, and the low chronology comes to that point. 30 to 80 years is a super challenge with radiocarbon because of those calibration curves and the variations of radiocarbon being formed in the upper atmosphere by cosmic rays. So that's part of the tension. But these folks, whereas in years past, generally biblical archaeologists have been cool to chilly about radiocarbon, treating it rather superfluous, but that has been changing over the years as the radiocarbon methods have gotten better and resulted in a major conference in this book that was published, released in 2005. And I'm going to show you one specific example. The best practices that come out of this effort by the radiocarbon community really emphasize a lot of very careful control of apply it systematically, stringent high-quality control in the sampling effort, in the laboratory effort, inter-laboratory comparisons time after time after time, multiple duplicate and triplicate samples to try to get the best possible results. So now let's look at a location where copper smelting has been observed at an archaeological dig in Edom, which is southern Jordan. The location is Jerusalem, the Dead Sea. This particular location is Kirbat en Nahas, and they abbreviate it in the literature as Ken for short, and I can connect with that pretty easily. Helen and I had the opportunity to meet Tom Levy, who is an archaeological researcher at University of California, San Diego, because shortly after Greg got me this book, my wife and I were headed to California for other purposes, and I called him and he gave us about 15 to 20 minutes to stop into his office. So I can get an extra personal connection as having visited with him and gotten some of his papers, and now I'm going to show you an example of a result. He and his team have observed the evidence of basically slag from a smelting process. They have demonstrated that, in fact, even thousands of years ago, they can get to high enough temperatures to smelt out copper by putting charcoal and copper ore-type material into a little pit in the ground like that, and they blow on it for a couple of hours, and they'll get some copper dripping out from smelting the copper. They can get up to the necessary temperatures. So there's an example. And they make the interpretation that the copper materials that were made were probably considered quite valuable because they were so difficult to make. And there's a sample that they found in that Ken archaeological dig that is about this particular piece is about an inch by an inch and a half in its size. The challenge is getting there in terms of analyzing the data, because a simple answer gives a range of, say, 100 to 200 years. That is an individual measured value. So the sequence that they apply is, number one, is intensive and very, very careful study of the stratigraphy. So they know exactly where the samples came from, very careful about thinking of the type of samples. Piece of charcoal could be wood from a multiple number of years, whereas a seed grows, certain types of seeds would grow in 1 year. So there are differences there. Then the complexity of the data leads them to using a statistical approach to analyze that data. As an example, with the 100 to 200 year range, the calibration curves, as you could see, were made up of lots of samples, so there's statistics involved with the calibration curves. Difficult to just make that easy interpretation with the eye, so they apply some statistics in a methodology that they describe as Bayesian or Bayesian modeling. Those of you that are mathematics people, I'll be glad to share some examples of this. And I can give you a paper that responds to it. So in this example, 100 radiocarbon dates were processed, and for the first time, these researchers feel that they have shown that copper production in Edom, just there in southern Jordan, was in fact during the 10th and 9th centuries BC. So Tom Levy, at the end of the day, argues that only with enthusiastic adoption of radiocarbon dating in the Iron Age of the southern Levant will it be possible to objectively investigate the relationship between historical texts and archaeology of this period. So he's obviously, as an archaeologist, become persuaded. As I prepared this, was preparing this abstract, I noticed a reference to some earthquakes in the area of the Dead Sea that impacted some sediments. And there's an example of contorted sediments, and radiocarbon comes into play. The Dead Sea is along an active fault. In one site, they found 8 deformed layers, and they tied them to historical quakes, 64 BC, 31 BC, and 33 AD would be the time of the crucifixion and the temple impacted by that earthquake. There's an example that they consider that 33 AD. These are thin layers of aragonite, which are calcium carbonate, that get contorted and busted up as the earth shakes there and affects those sediments. Because of these things that I'm showing you about radiocarbon, we like to bring this and we want to bring this to seminaries. So we prepared a one-day workshop where we first share our biblical interpretation and then we share with pastors these tree rings, ice cores, VARs, radiometric dating methods that I've been showing to you. Greg Davidson and Greg Bennett are my colleagues in this effort. Greg Bennett is here with us. Greg Davidson is a professor at Old Miss, and we show the tree rings, VARs, ice cores to help them understand what geologists learn about the history of the Earth with these, showing these correlations of 3 different things that fit together so nicely. Greg has written a book on the topic, When Faith and Science Collide, and how to address issues of evolution and the age of the Earth. So radiocarbon is a pretty good tool, we believe, for looking back about 50,000 years. It must be calibrated because of the carbon-14 production in the upper atmosphere varies. A calendar age can be obtained from a calibration curve. And for biblical archaeology to resolve those less than 100-year bands, it's more than just a simple sending a sample out. It's a lot of very careful work. Thank you very, very much. Yes, please. The 33 is the historical record. That's not the radiocarbon.
Oh, okay.
That's historical. They know the earthquake occurred from historical records.
Okay. So that's just speculation that the
That is their best interpretation by looking at that geological section.
Okay.
Radiocarbon is used for earthquakes that go on back to about 10,000 years, but time didn't permit me to build that into this talk. We wanted to focus more. And then once I got digging more, there were not as issues as interesting directly to archaeology, which is our objective here. Yes, please. Other questions? Or one more? Glad to chat some more about it afterward, too. Yes, please. So far, we have been at Covenant in St. Louis, which was a very good experience. It helped us sort of cut our teeth on doing this. Very well received, and I have some flyers that I'd share with you that gave some of the people's comments. So far, we have been also to Moody Bible Institute. Again, well received, a mix of support from the faculty. One faculty member was just elated Others were cool. We want to get into Dallas. We want to get into Trinity. We want to get into eventually the Baptist seminaries. Please help us. There was another down here, maybe one more. Okay, chat with me later. That'd be just fine.
Thank you, Ken. Hey, Ken, can we keep your clock up here? Thank you. Very helpful. Well, actually, the next two talks are really designed to be part of a single piece, so to speak. So I'm going to introduce myself and the next speaker. I'll tell you a little bit more about Jim later.